Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, I'm speaking again with Michael Newton Keyes, author of the new book Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion, published by ISI Books. Keyes is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and a former Fulbright scholar. After earning a PhD in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma, he won research grants from the National Science Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies, among others. He is currently serving as lecturer in the history and philosophy of science at Biola University and is on the board of directors of Ratio Christi, an alliance of apologetics clubs on college campuses. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, Andrew. Let's chat about some interesting topics like, you know, how the world is made, and whether it moves or not.
There you go. Well, your new book debunks seven of the most popular and pernicious myths about science and religion. In previous episodes, we've been taking an in-depth look at each myth, where it comes from, why it persists today, and the truth of the matter. The topic of chapter 6 of your book is this: Did Copernicus demote Earth and theistic religion? Well, let's jump right into that. What was Nicholas Copernicus's greatest achievement?
Well, I kind of set that up by saying, you know, does the Earth move or not? Of course, we know now it certainly does move, but back at this time, it was really not established at all. There were no experiments that could show that Earth moved at that time. But what Nicholas Copernicus achieved was to come up with a complete mathematical system to show that if you assume the Earth moves, that is, around the sun, and that the sun's at least rest locally here, that you can make sense of all the phenomena that had traditionally been explained by the opposite assumption that Earth is at rest and the sun goes around it. So that was quite an achievement. And even though evidentially both views could make sense of the empirical evidence about equally well, that is the old geocentric system of Ptolemy and the new Copernican Earth-moving system, but Copernicus' theory had some advantages that philosophers of science identify by the term theoretical virtue or theory virtues, qualities of theories that make them stand out as more likely to be true. For example, it tended to have more internal conceptual coherence, less sort of ad hoc, and is another way to put it in a negative way. That is, the theoretical components seem to fit together well rather than just sort of tacked on to solve isolated problems. So that was one thing that Copernicus seemed to have an advantage over the old geocentric view. And it also was a simpler theory, seemed to explain the same facts with a little less theoretical content, at least in some respects. But of course, that was debatable still at the time. So it was, as we talked about when we did the Galileo affair, it was certainly not a clear-cut case whether the Copernican system was true or not, but at least it was worthy of pursuit.
Sure. Well, did his work demote humans from the privileged center of the universe, as it's sometimes thought of, and thereby challenge religious doctrines about human importance? Did he do that?
Well, a lot of people later on thought he did. Even very recently, the late Christopher Hitchens identified this as Christianity's greatest failure in a debate. In fact, at Biola University, where I still teach part-time. But you'll find it in astronomy textbooks, statements like, you know, well, humankind has been torn from its throne at the center of the cosmos due to the Copernican achievement and the like. But it actually was not considered at the time to be a demotion for the following reason. The Aristotelian cosmology that had made its way through the Middle Ages into this early modern period, according to that cosmology, the center of the cosmos was the place where heavy things, gross things fall, where things fall apart. Earth, water, air, and fire come together and fall apart, and it's the place of corruption in the center. But up in the heavens, that's the place that was considered incorruptible, because the heavens seem to be changeless except for the regular periodic motions of the points of light, planets and stars that seem to go around the Earth. So we still kind of carry a vestige of this ancient medieval view in our language when we use the term dead center. That is, doesn't sound very affirming, dead center. But the way the story is told, it made it look like, retrospectively, when we take the modern view of center being the place of more importance, it made it look like Copernicus was demoting our planet to an insignificant place, not in the center of any divine plan. Humans couldn't certainly be made in God's image because we're just not important cosmologically, or so the story goes. But of course, there's more to the story than that.
Sure. Well, how did early Copernicans such as Kepler and Galileo interpret the human implications of this new astronomy?
Well, Galileo once wrote that he would prove that the Earth has motion. Now, he didn't actually do that, but he tried. You know, he did his best to prove that. But he goes on to say that the Earth has motion and that Earth is not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. Sounds like sort of the cesspool of the cosmos, the center. So he's framing his argument for a moving Earth as a promotion. Kepler took this promotional stance even further by making an argument that actually still can be refurbished today. It's kind of a privileged planet theory. And of course, our colleagues, Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards, have a book by that title. But here's the original privileged planet thesis that Kepler promoted. He said, well, really, it makes sense for us to be in motion to make us better able to do science, because when you're in motion around the sun, your platform of observation is able to see the sun and Venus and other inner planets from different angles, for example, and you can draw triangles on sort of the orbital shapes of these resulting, you know, if you assume the sun is at rest and the Earth moves around the sun, and you can then triangulate to figure out how far Venus is from the sun in comparison to how far Earth is, which is one astronomical unit. So using the basic traits of the geometry of triangles to figure out how far things away. And you couldn't use this method if Earth were at rest in the center. You wouldn't have the same moving platform of observation to triangulate. And kind of like a surveyor will take two sightings and then use that as a baseline to triangulate to calculate a distance. Just kind of think like a surveyor and you get Kepler's idea. So sure. he argued that a moving Earth is makes it a privileged planet because we're able to do more science that way, you know, design for discovery type thing.
Right. So it really made the astronomy simpler to understand and for all the details to come together.
Yeah. And actually, if the Earth does move, it creates new opportunities for measurements that would be impossible without question-begging assumptions on a geocentric view. So Kepler thought that advantage was very much in keeping with the divine maker. He did believe in God as the creator of the world, and that motivated his science. And he thought, you know, this is just the kind of universe that God would have created, with Earth as a moving object rather than at rest, and less science worthy if it were at rest.
Mm-hmm. So it really allowed us to eat some humble pie, but at the same time gave us that grander perspective of the universe, which isn't necessarily going against Christian thinking.
Yeah, and like I say, Galileo framed it as a promotion up higher into the heavens. That would be against the Aristotelian backdrop considered a promotion. But Kepler had a much more substantial promotional perspective on a moving Earth, that it makes it a better place to do science.
Sure. Well, as with all myths, things start to get distorted. How did the generation after Galileo begin distorting the Copernican legacy?
Well, through this period, the modern idea of center as being the place of importance gradually took shape, kind of like when you say, you know, don't be so self-centered or egocentric, you know, like I'm the center of everything, you know, like a childish view. That modern psychological interpretation of centrality had gradually developed during this early modern period. And then by the time of this generation after Galileo, people began to read that back into the past. In the time of Copernicus, which is, you know, back in 1543, a century earlier, and then rendering the Copernican achievement as a demotion for Earth. But that was a trick of anachronistic trading, where you're trading a modern view and imposing it on an earlier modern view and assuming that makes sense of the historic event. But that's anachronistic. That does violence to history. It's not accurate history.
Sure. Well, what are some more recent extensions to the Copernican demotion storyline that we might find in astronomy textbooks?
Yeah, in fact, I survey about a dozen astronomy textbooks currently used in classrooms just to show that doing the history of science and philosophy of science helps to better evaluate the way arguments are framed in current textbooks. So, and I'm talking college textbooks here. So, so for example, one textbook makes the statement after rehearsing the usual Copernican's demotion story, it extends that story to say, well, now we also know that we're not even in the center of the galaxy. We're in a, quote, unremarkable position on the periphery of the Milky Way, to quote this one textbook. Now, what's really curious about this textbook and many others like it is that most textbooks today discuss what's called the galactic habitable zone. That's the kind of the ring between the center of the galaxy and the outskirts within which habitable planets can possibly form because of a variety of traits that are just right in that region. But it's curious that these same textbooks often spin our non-central galactic location as a demotion, like, oh, we're not, you know, an important part of God's plan. But it also, they also say that, well, this non-central location is actually special because of the, it's in the galactic habitable zone. So it's, this is weird because you have this old template, this story of, you know, demotion, demotion, demotion in a Copernican style that keeps getting updated and reused mindlessly, even though it's at odds with the specialness of our location in the galactic habitable zone. So this is where history matters today, because bad history can distort contemporary science education. And that's important, isn't it, Andrew?
It really is. And in fact, you say that in your book, that the demotion myth is distorting our assessment of current astronomical evidence. And you go into detail about that. Well, how do some atheistic astronomers attempt to salvage some meaning and dignity despite their perpetuation of the Copernican demotion myth?
This is where I will call in my man, Neil deGrasse Tyson. he's just the man for the job here. He likes to spin his trademark, the cosmic perspective, as he calls it, as like, you know, back off, man. I'm a scientist. I've got the cosmic perspective. And what is this perspective? Well, to quote his forward to an astronomy textbook that happens to have the title The Cosmic Perspective, after his trademark expression there, he writes that the cosmic perspective says that the cosmos is not a benevolent cradle designed to nurture life, but a lonely, hazardous place. And of course, he's referring to how the vast majority of the universe is not habitable. And he's spinning that in an atheistic rhetorical way by saying, you know, no God would have made a universe with all this vast space and objects in it that are not habitable. And of course, we discuss this in The Big Myth, that C.S. Lewis punctures this as empty atheistic rhetoric, because you, regardless of how the universe might be full of life or rarely rare life, atheists will find something to complain about, won't they, Andrew?
Sure, sure.
But he goes on to say that this cosmic perspective opposes the childish view that the universe figuratively and literally revolves around us. So he's setting this up. He's kind of like saying we should realize that we're not special by the standard Copernican demotion story, but we are special after all. He turns it right around in a way that's unwittingly very much like Psalm 8, where the psalmist says, oh, man, you look at the cosmos. It looks like we're so tiny. You know, what is man, that God, that you are mindful of him? But then there's the and yet. And Tyson has his own and yet. I mean, the biblical motif is, and yet we're made in God's image and we have a special place even though we're tiny. And his, Tyson's and yet is, I'll quote it. He says, the cosmic perspective is spiritual, even redemptive, but not religious. And by spiritual, he means, you know, oh, wow, the awe, the sense of awe he has when he's looking into the heavens, as we all have. He thinks that's a spiritual experience, an atheistic spiritual experience, and he thinks it redeems us from the idea of benevolent design. Now, this is just muddled atheistic sentimentality. It's not really an argument. He's just using language, spinning it to make it look like he's the scientist, he's got the cosmic perspective, he's spiritual, but he's not religious, because we're spiritual because we know science. We can look up into the sky, and we can figure out all these things. We feel an intellectual high from it, and man, how smart we are. So we are special after all because we do science. But really, yeah. There's not really an argument here. It's just, like I say, muddled atheist sentimentality.
Sure. Well, it's special, not special, or it's not special, but we're special. it reminds me of my favorite cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory. Do you know what it is?
No.
It's the mango key lime. Ooh. It is absolutely to die for. But, you know, if I eat that slice of mango key lime cheesecake, it's gone. You know, I can't have my cake and eat it too. And it sounds like that's what they're trying to do here.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a lot of fun with this. And this significance void that's left by the Copernican demotion story and other historic myths kind of lead into another myth. But we'll have to talk about that another time.
Yeah, we will. Well, Mike, thanks for taking the time to explore this with us. It's really exciting to unpack these, and especially this one. It just deals with that vastness, the universe as we see it. You know, when we go outside and look at the stars, there's different perspectives, but it's really nice that you're unpacking this myth that's connected to that. Well, for more information on Mike's book, Unbelievable, you can visit unbelievablemyths.com. Unbelievablemyths.com. Find the rest of my conversations with Michael Keyes at idthefuture.com or search for ID the Future in your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.